Okay, questions? Questions? There are probably more questions about this WebAssign set than I've seen in the past. So if you haven't started it, expect problems, I guess is what I would say. Well, so there's one problem that has the numbers wrong. No, it's not the last one. It's the one that has the block of ice that's floating. Maybe they changed it, but at least I saw myself, so I can confirm it for somebody. They had a thickness of glycerin that was 0.1 meters, which is, you know, that much glycerin. And it meant 0.1 millimeters. Or at least to get the green check, you needed to say 0.1 millimeters. So the other thing that I got lots of email on is registration. So there, if you have registered for what you want, you're probably in the minority. There are lots of problems with registration. And I can't guarantee that they'll be solved, but they pretty much always have been in the past. So I think that there will be a solution, but it's a big enough problem that it's not going to happen overnight. So don't expect overrides to occur tomorrow. They're not going to. They're probably going to have to add new sections, or something moderately big has to happen in order to solve the problem for, I don't know, on the order of 20 kids. Other questions?
I shall never have this problem.
So I wrote lots of equations on this review board, but I'm not sure any of them really deserve to make it to the formula sheet. There are a lot of kind of particular cases. I've written some of these on here because I've seen them myself on practice MCAT texts, like this one here. But they've never expected you to know that equation, like memorize it. They've given you that equation when you've used it. So that's kind of an important equation that gives you flow rates when viscosity is important, and it applies to lots of flows in living creatures. So it's often used by biologists. But it's a complicated equation that deals with a particular case, so it's kind of not memorable. The definition of viscosity is probably the most general and useful equation on the board, and maybe that one deserves to go on your cheat sheet. But it's a lot of special cases, so I'm not sure that there's a lot here. I guess the other thing I would comment, this is maybe more from last time in the past, so heretofore, kind of the only numbers that I asked you to know were 9.8 meters per second squared, and we're starting to get into remembering material properties. And knowing the density of water is 1,000 kilograms per cubic meter, or a gram per milliliter, which is the same as a gram per cubic centimeter, and that atmospheric pressure is about 100,000 pascals. Those are useful numbers to know and probably should go on your cheat sheet. My guess is I would give you them on an exam. Similarly, the gas constant is another one that's coming up. So I'm not sure those are exactly worth memorizing, but they probably deserve a spot on your cheat sheet. So viscosity is kind of friction in fluids. Reynolds number is a number that we use to determine whether the flow is going to be smooth and time independent, which is to say laminar, or whether it's going to be turbulent. So at large Reynolds number, we expect turbulent flow. And exactly what large is depends on the physical situation. So our book talks about 2,000 or so being a large Reynolds number for flow in pipes. So surfaces are typically bounded by kind of a rubberish membrane that takes work to expand. So there's energy per area or force per length that is that property of surface tension. And the contact then that we have between, say, glass and mercury and air, that contact angle depends on the forces that are involved. So for gasoline, for example, you know that it doesn't form little droplets. On water, it would spread out totally covering the surface. That's because this surface tension of water and air, is bigger than those surface tensions combined, so that layer gets stretched out until it's infinitely thin. I don't think we had any homework problems on diffusion, but these sorts of situations are pretty common under lots of circumstances where we have a change in a quantity in space causes a flow of that quantity. So here we're thinking about an unequal concentration of a chemical. That change in concentration with position times the diffusion constant should give you the flux, the number of moles per second per cross-sectional area that would flow as a result. So a diffusion constant is something you would look up in CRC for various circumstances. It would depend on the materials that are involved. Same thing with viscosity, right? Viscosity depends noticeably on temperature, so it's not a constant like the water density is pretty constant. It changes like a factor of 3 between room temperature and boiling point of water. But those are tabulated in CRC, and they're certainly not worth memorizing. Questions? So I'm thinking today we have a relatively easy set of material to cover, because I'm thinking most of this stuff you've covered before, and maybe you'll just be surprised. So the hardest thing we have to talk about is the ideal gas law. Is there anyone who will admit to not having worked dozens of problems with the ideal gas law? Quite a few. It's been a while, huh? So it's out of Gen Chem now, I guess. So, whatever they call it now, right? There are new names for all of those courses. So this is an equation that deals with a so-called ideal gas, and P is the pressure, V is the volume that the gas is confined to, T is the temperature, more on that in a second, and N is the number of moles. Do we need to talk about moles at all? Anyone care to admit, not being familiar with how to calculate? If I give you 40 grams of carbon dioxide, can you tell me how many moles there are? Yes, good. So that, of course, requires the gram molecular weight, which you can look up on the periodic table, add up those gram molecular weights for your molecule. Get the number of grams per mole, and a mole is just a big number, about 6 times 10 to the 23rd atoms or molecules in a mole. So the main use of this equation is often not so much in this form, but where we're setting things up in proportion. So pretty commonly, for example, you have the same block of gas that you've heated up or you've changed the volume of or something like that, so that the number of moles and the gas constant is a constant. So that means that the pressure times the volume divided by the temperature has to be the same under one situation and in another situation. So then we can set up this sort of proportion to figure out what the new volume, pressure, and temperature is under changed circumstances. Now the one thing that's critical to remember is that, well, maybe there are two of them, but the most critical one is to remember that this temperature can't be in Fahrenheit, it can't be in Celsius, it has to be in absolute degrees. And the metric system, the unit we have for absolute temperature is called Kelvin, and absolute zero is minus 273 degrees Celsius, which is, I don't know, minus 450 or something like that Fahrenheit. We'll pretty much never be using Fahrenheit degrees. So temperatures in absolute degrees always are positive, and they're measured above the lowest possible temperature, which is absolute zero. So these are degrees above absolute zero. So So, I mean, there are cold things around. Liquid helium has a typically has a temperature of about 4 degrees above absolute zero. Todd, who's another physicist here, has typically worked with gases that are about a millionth of a degree above absolute zero. So you can get very, very close to absolute zero, but you can't get below absolute zero. So I'm not sure what unit of degrees you're most used to. Fahrenheit is what the weather reports all the time. Celsius is what the rest of the world uses for temperatures. And if you want to convert between Celsius and Fahrenheit, my favorite way of doing it is that equation. So if you know either Celsius or Fahrenheit, you can plug into that equation and solve for the other version of it. Once you've got the temperature in Celsius, you can add absolute zero, 273.15 degrees, to that to get the temperature in degrees Kelvin. Okay. So Celsius degrees, I take it you know that 0 degrees is about equal to the melting point of ice, and 100 degrees is about equal to the boiling point of water. In fact, that's not exactly how those things are, that's how they were defined long ago, but there are more precise definitions for Celsius these days. Fahrenheit, ice is going to freeze at about 32 degrees, and the boiling point of water is 212 degrees Fahrenheit.
What's Kelvin equal to again?
So Kelvin is degrees above absolute zero. And you can calculate it by taking the Celsius degrees and adding 273.15 to it. There's an absolute system that goes with the Fahrenheit degrees, which is called Rentgen or something like that, but I've never seen it used in practice. Okay. So, I don't know, one famous temperature is 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit. What's that in degrees Celsius? Well, we can just plug and chug into this equation. So, 5 times 98.6 minus 9C is supposed to be 160. So if I bring the minus 9C to this side of the equation, 160 to the other, so the temperature in degrees Celsius is going to be 5 times 98.6 minus 160 divided by 9. And you really should know the answer to this without running it on your calculator. Anybody know the answer without running it? Yes, I heard the right answer. It's supposed to come out 37, and it does. Right, so human body temperature, 37 degrees Celsius. Okay, so the middle two equations have to do with particularly how old-fashioned thermometers were made. So the old-fashioned mercury thermometer contains a bunch of mercury that's in the bottom of something that has a long tube. When you change the temperature on any sort of object, it's going to expand a little bit, and so the mercury will expand up to a certain point that depends on how much the temperature is changed. So we can put little calibration marks on the side that correspond to how much expansion the mercury has undergone. So the amount of volume change is pretty small, so we have a relatively big reservoir and a pretty thin capillary that's giving us the change in volume. And the exact relationship between the change in volume, the change in temperature, depends on a constant that you can look up in CRC. It's not a memorable constant. It's different for every material, that gives the relationship to the change in volume and the change in temperature. Another way that thermometers are sometimes made is by taking up, and this is often how thermostats work, by taking two materials that are different. So just to make up names, let's say that this one's copper and this one's iron. And every material, when you heat it up, is going to expand, both in terms of its volume and its length. So if one of these expands more than the other, let's say the iron expands more, the only thing that can happen is it can be twisted so that it has a bigger outer circumference than the copper has. So the amount of deflection of this bimetal strip can also give you an indication of temperature. Yes?
They used to use mercury all the time in thermometers. What is the liquid in there now?
So it's pretty commonly an alcohol. So you typically want something that won't freeze at, you know, normal sorts of temperatures. But anything, theoretically, anything would work. Everything expand, anything that's a liquid would work just fine. And so the red is just colorant, right? Because you know alcohols are typically colorless. Questions? Okay, well, we can try and demonstrate these things. All the way over here. So this is supposedly a bimetallic strip. And supposedly, I didn't test this before class, maybe I should have. You can see the huge change in its length as it bends. I can see it. There, I can. Maybe you can start to see it.
Oh, yeah.
Not as straight as it used to be. Now, one kind of tricky question about linear expansion is what happens to the hole? If you have a hole in something, I've said that the length in it increase. Does the hole get filled in from the material on the outside, or does the hole also increase in size? Oh, what do you think? Yeah. Bent enough. So currently, this piece of material doesn't go through this loop. One thing that you might argue is that if this thing is heated, it gets bigger the way kind of a donut would get bigger. The inside would get filled in and the outside would expand. But if we heat this thing up, you'll see that holes and the object, everything, gets proportionally bigger. It's just like if you take a photograph of something and on your favorite photo manipulation program, you just expand things, right? The holes get bigger, everything gets bigger, and now this thing goes through just fine. Okay. So let's take a look at some of the typical sorts of problems. So often the first thing to do here is to do some temperature conversion problems. So I know one place to start. Who wants to claim the coldest temperature they've personally experienced? That's pretty cold. That's better than me. Although, I was told before I knew it, it was colder than that. So minus 47 degrees Fahrenheit. Anyone beat that? The coldest it's been here, well, I've been here, is about minus 40. And minus 50 is, I'm not sure that's on the order of probably the coldest temperature in Minnesota, I would guess. Yep, I mean, that's a perfectly credible temperature. So the corresponding temperature, this is obviously below freezing, so we're going to get a negative number for Celsius. So we have 5 times minus 47, minus 9C is 160. So we got 5 times minus 47, minus 160 is equal to 9C. So the Celsius temperature is 5 times minus 47, minus 160. So everything's negative in the numerator. And we divide it by 9. So we've got 47, 5 times it, 160, No. 47, 5 times it. Yeah, I believe that. Minus 43.9. So it turns out that minus 40 is kind of the magic point. That's the temperature that's the same numerically in Celsius and Fahrenheit. Okay, so here we got a little bit colder. Let's call that minus 80 in Alaska. What's the corresponding temperature? So works the same way. 5 times F minus 9C is 160. So we've got 5 times 180 minus 160 is equal to 9C. So the Celsius temperature, and these are all negative numbers in the numerator. So we've got so that's going to be minus 62.2. What is that in absolute degrees? So absolute temperature is always positive, and what we're supposed to do is add 273.15 to get what this thing is in Kelvin. So that's what it was in Celsius. Notice a little technical detail. There's no degree sign with the Kelvin, right? There's a little degree symbol that goes with Celsius and Fahrenheit, but it's just K's. So we've got a hot temperature that's 134 degrees. So that's, I mean, kind of ballparking this, that's on the order of halfway to boiling point. And we know that boiling point in Celsius is 100 degrees, so we're thinking 50 degrees or something like that in terms of Celsius. So if we run her through, we've got 5 times 134 minus 160 divided by 9. That's all supposed to equal to the Celsius. And I've got 56.7 degrees Celsius. If I want that in Kelvin, all I have to do is to add the 273.15, and I get 329.8. Okay, so unit conversion for Fahrenheit and Celsius, you should be up to doing that. 23 is, I think, a real interesting question, but let's skip over it for a second. So here we have a long rod that's 1,300 kilometers long. It's the Trans-Alaskan pipeline. And we have temperature changes that are going to go from minus 73C to plus 35C. And we're supposed to ask, how much does the steel pipeline expand? So in order to work this problem, we have to look up what this number alpha is in the book, the thermal coefficient of expansion for iron. And I have that as 1.73 times 10 to the minus 6 per degree Celsius. So its units are 1 over the degree Celsius. No. Nope. 11 times 10 to the minus 6th. Yeah. Unsure enough about this, let's check her out again. So there's this nice picture at the top of chapter 10 that shows you the what you have to do to get around this process. Yeah, so 11 times 10 to the minus 6 on page 338. So the change in length is the length times that coefficient times the change in temperature, and the temperature can go from 35 to minus 73. So minus and minus is plus, so this is 108. And the length of the pipeline is 1,300 kilometers. So I'm going to get a change of length that's in kilometers. You can see that the Celsius degrees are going to cancel out. So I've got 108, 11, minus 6. And the change in length is about 1.5 kilometers. So it's about a mile. So that's length, expansion, or contraction. Liquids work the same way. So we said how a mercury thermometer works is the extra volume is pushed up a capillary. Here we have the extra volume that's just going to spill on the floor. So we've got a 50-gallon container of carbon tetrachloride, which you shouldn't have, 5.8 times 10 to the minus 4th. Yeah, it's a bad one. And so the question is, how much of this is going to spill out when the temperature increases by 20 degrees Celsius? So the formula is the same. The change in volume is the volume times the expansion coefficient, and they tell us what that is: 5.81 times 10 to the minus 4th times the change in temperature, which is 20 degrees Celsius. So the volume we start out with is 50 gallons, and we've got a beta that is 5.81 times 10 to the minus 4th. The unit we're going to get out of this is gallons, because the degrees Celsius are going to cancel. And what I get is about half a gallon. And so 2 liters or so of stuff is going to be dumped on the ground. So with that, let's go back to this question here, which is a pretty common situation. So the plan is to heat some... Question?
Yeah, just a note-keeping thing. What's the difference between alpha, gamma, and beta in all of our equations?
Yeah. So we've run out of letters, so often we'll double use them. So we're going to have even more alphas and betas that are different in the future.
Well, yeah, I know. I understand that they're not like an acceleration thing. Just
yeah, so these gammas were surface tension.
Yep. Yeah,
and I'm not going to bother with that area equation.
Okay.
So here we have alpha, which is the length expansion, and here we have beta, that's the volume expansion.
Okay.
We've run out of letters.
Those are just constants that will be in our book. And
say again?
Those will be either given to us or in our book, right?
They are definitely not memorable, right? So I would not write them on your cheat sheet. If I have a problem like that on an exam, I'd have to give you, just like this. Yeah, so I guess increasingly we've seen problems in WebAssign where they have asked you to go and look up something in a table, like the density of iron. And they haven't given you that to you in a problem. Okay, so this particular problem is a pretty common occurrence where you heat something up and cause it to expand, and then you can fit it onto something, and when it cools down, it'll be really tightly held. And what we're supposed to do is figure out in this circumstance, what's the force that results when we do this process. So in the particular case, they're talking about dentistry, so we have this little band of stainless steel, and they give us the dimensions, the height, the width, and the thickness, and they say that they heated it up not to the boiling point of water, to 80 degrees Celsius, and then they're going to let it cool down to mouth temperature, to 37 degrees Celsius, and they're asking what's the resulting tension. So this harkens back to the earlier equation that said that when we apply force, when we apply stresses, we get strains. So the change in length per length, that when multiplied by Young's modulus gave us the force per cross-sectional area. So we have this band, you know, it looks kind of like that. The area we're talking about is the cross-sectional area of this this little tooth device, and that has a thickness that is half of a millimeter. And it's got a height that is 4 millimeters. So that's the area that we're talking about in that equation. The length, of course, is the circumference. So when we heat this thing up, there's going to be an expansion of that material. And that expansion is going to, in the end, correspond to a given force when it cools down. Because it still has the same length it had when it was hot, but it doesn't have the same natural length. So the extra stretch that it has is the stretch that it had based on thermal expansion. So this is a way of generating pretty big forces. So the force then is going to be the area times Young's modulus times beta times the change in temperature. Change in temperature, we're told, is from 80 to 37. The area we've calculated there as 0.5 times 10 to the minus 3 meters times 4 times 10 to the minus 3 meters. The Young's modulus, we can... they give it to us, or do I look at it? Oh, they tell us that it's 18 times 10 to the 10th. And for the thermal expansion of stainless steel, they say 17 times 10 to the minus 6th. Yes?
Why were you able to use beta when the beta is in the volume equation?
Ah, thank you. Yep. The names, incidentally, the names of those constants are not like the A that we use for acceleration or the P that we use for momentum. But I definitely should be consistent. Was that the other question? No. So beta stands for a mistake.
Well, what is
the fish? The fish, the fish, which stands for alpha, is the called linear expansion coefficient. So it's how much things change in length for a change in temperature.
Linear
expansion coefficient. So something that has a big alpha, if you change its temperature, it's going to increase in length a lot. So there are materials that very intentionally are dimensionally stable. When you change the temperature, they don't change their length very much. So they'd have a very small value of alpha. So Pyrex is an example that of something that has a relatively small value of alpha. More questions? Okay, so it's plug and chug. So we've got an area that is 0.5 times 10 to the minus 3 by 4 times 10 to the minus 3. We have this absolutely huge number for Young's modulus. And we've got this fairly small value for linear expansion coefficient. And we've got a moderate temperature change. And I get, if I trust my work, I must, so my answer is disagree. So let me crank. Oh, I'm sorry. No, I guess I'm happy. So I get 1,800 newtons. Yeah, that's what was worrying me, but we didn't use it.
So, and that's because you converted it with the
other form. So what matters for thermal expansion is the fractional increase in length. And that same quantity is what matters for stretching. More questions? Okay, so... So we know that this is, so we have a force, and it's a force that's a compressive force. So it's a matter of whether you want to call that a negative or a positive value. So obviously if you put them in the other order, you're going to get a negative value for that force.
Right.
So maybe kind of pays your money and takes your choice. What is the case is that this length is smaller than it would be when you cool it down. So that delta L is negative. Whether we call this force negative or positive is just a sign convention. It is something that is holding the tooth together.
Did you get a different number for the force?
Yeah, did you get 200 and something?
Yeah,
268. That's what I have in my notes, too. So did I just crank it wrong? Yeah. Is that what you got? More questions.
Where did the delta L over L go?
So it kind of went away. This exact quantity occurs in thermal expansion and in the stress-strain relationship.
So essentially, all you're doing is setting them equal to each other because they're both equal.
Yes. Yep. So maybe it would be happier if I wrote this on the other side and then did it as an intermediate. Is that good to go? More questions? Okay, so ideal gas law problems. So 36 is kind of a very standard sort of problem. What we have is helium gas, and you might remember that the density of air was about 1.3 kilograms per cubic meter. So, I don't know, roughly speaking, helium is going to have a density that's a tenth of that, so much lighter than air. That, of course, goes with the fact that the gram molecular weight of helium is roughly a tenth that of typical air molecule. So we raise the temperature to the boiling point of water. We keep the pressure constant. What's the new density of helium? So our equation doesn't involve density. So how do we get density out of it? So if we look at the, so let's have kind of two situations. So situation one is at room temperature, which is to say at 273. Oops, yep, 273. That's the same thing, of course, as a degree Celsius that is 0 degrees. And situation two is at the boiling point. And that's where the Celsius degrees are 100, which is to say that the absolute temperature is 373. And according to the setup, we can take P1 V1 over T1 being the same thing as P2 V2 over T2. Because the number of moles of helium is the same in situation 1 and situation 2. We also know that the pressure is the same in situation 1 and situation 2. So we can say that the expanded volume when it's hot, just bring this guy down, is equal to the ratio of the temperatures. Well, so we see that the volume expands when it's warm. How does that get us to density? Well, remember that density is mass over volume. So if I divide both sides, well, what's the best way of doing this? Yeah, so here I'm going to have V2 over the mass, and here I'm going to have the mass over V1, just multiplying and dividing by the mass. What I've got then is the density in situation 1, and this is 1 over the density in situation 2. So what we have then is that if we bring this density up and the other things down, we've got the density in situation 1, in situation 2 is the density in situation 1 times T1 over T2. And frankly, the way to work these problems is often not to think your way through this, but instead to figure out what's going to happen and just set up the appropriate ratios. So I hope it's clear that at the higher temperature, the density should go down. And so we should expect that the higher temperature should be in the denominator. And you can set things up then as a sequence of ratios to get the final number. Right, so to get our number here, we've got the density to start out with, which is 0.179. We've got the ratio of temperatures, which is 273 over 373. And we could just plug and chug to get what the density is in the new situation. One of the nice reasons to set these problems up as ratios like this is because it's clear what the units are, right? The ratio of temperatures is going to be unitless. So the units we have coming out are going to be the same as the units that we had going in. Okay, so I kind of recommend just writing down the ratios of things that change and realizing, by knowing how gases work, whether you want situation 1 on the numerator and the denominator, and multiply them all together, and you should get the answer you want. Okay, so problem 30 is a little bit more complicated because it involves a change in the number of moles in addition to change in temperature. So the story is we've got a 20-liter tank of carbon dioxide. The pressure is, roughly speaking, 9 atmospheres, and the temperature is starting out at 19 degrees Celsius. So in order to do anything with the ideal gas law, we're going to need our temperatures in absolute degrees, so they have us converting. They want us to calculate the number of moles so that we can plug into PV equals NRT. You all know, I hope, what the gram molecular weights are of carbon and oxygen. 12 and 16, close enough, right? There are isotopes, so they're not exactly those numbers. So we can then calculate the number of grams of carbon dioxide. We have a change in temperature. We have a change in mass, that is to say we have a leak, and now we're supposed to figure out what the new final pressure is. Okay, so a multi-step problem in which basically all of these quantities are changing. Okay, so we've got 19 degrees Celsius, and we know to get Kelvin we need to add 273, close enough 0.15 if you want to do that. So we've got a temperature that is 292 Kelvin. We know the gram molecular weight of carbon dioxide. Carbon famously is 12, maybe not quite so famously, oxygen is 16. So we've got two 16s and a 12. So that's our gram molecular weight. And we've got, we can figure out how many moles we have, and from that we can figure out how many grams we have by using the ideal gas law. So the number of moles are going to be the pressure times the volume divided by the gas constant, which is basically 8.3, times the temperature. So we do have to use consistent units. The volume has been given to us in liters. So a liter is 1,000 cubic centimeters, and a cubic centimeter is a millionth of a cubic meter. So there is 1 liter equals 1,000th of a cubic meter. So we've got a volume that is 0.02 cubic meters. So we've got a pressure that is 9.5 times 10 to the fifth. We've got our volume that is 0.02 cubic meters. Got our gas constant that is 8.31 joules per mole Kelvin. We've got an absolute temperature that is 293 degrees Kelvin. Let's take a second to think about what the units are going to be. So in the numerator, we have pascals times cubic meters. And a pascal is a newton per square meter. So in the numerator, we've got a newton meter, which is a unit of work that we call joule. So we've got joules here, we've got joules there, we've got K's canceling there. So the only units we've got are 1/1 over moles, so our answer is indeed going to be in moles. So we've got 9.5 times 10 to the fifth, and 0.02, and 8.31 dividing it by, and 292 divided by that, and we get 7.83 moles. Now we're going to leak out 82 grams. And we know that in 1 mole, there are 44 grams. So in terms of leakage, we're going to lose about 1.86 moles. So after the fire, we've got basically 6 moles, 5.97 moles. So we've done this, we've calculated, we haven't So I'm having trouble figuring out what they mean by calculate the new temperature. If this is the temperature. Oh, thank you. Thank you. Okay, so that isn't the temperature, that's the increased temperature. Okay, so we got 244 added onto that for our final temperature. Say again?
224.
Ah, dyslexia. 292, 224. Our new temperature is 516. So the pressure is going to be nRT divided by the volume. We have the number of moles, 5.97. Got our gas constant, which is 8.3. And we've got our temperature, which is 516. And we've got our volume, which is still the same. The volume of the tank didn't change. Okay, so 5.97 moles, 8.31. I had my 916, 0.02 divided by it. And I get a pressure that is 1.28 times 10 to the 6th. Pascals. That's what I got this way. So let's, for those of you who haven't done much kind of an ideal gas law problems, let's kind of make up another problem before we try some iQuiz questions. And one of the advantages of thinking about these things in terms of ratios is we don't have to use a lot of unit conversion. So let's pick kind of funny units. So let's say that the initial volume was 22.4 liters and the initial pressure was atmospheric pressure and the initial temperature was 300 Kelvin, which is a little bit of a warm room temperature. And that same gas is, we compress it to 10 liters and we subject it to a pressure that is 2 atmospheres, and we're supposed to find the resulting temperature. So we can say that P1 V1 over T1 is P2 V2 over T2. And if I bring my T2 up and my T1 up and bring the other things down, I have T2 is T1, and then I have the ratio of pressures and the ratio of volumes. Okay, so 300 Kelvin, P2 over P1 is 2 atmospheres, V2 over V1 is 22.4 divided by 10, and all I need to do is to multiply those numbers all together in order to get the resulting change. Thank you. Makes much more sense that way. Ah, I see what my problem was. Thank you. questions? So one of the questions you might have behind all of this is mean length and mass and speed. Those are all things you can kind of understand. What exactly is temperature? Any ideas? So it certainly relates to energy. So which has a higher temperature? Lake Superior with ice floating in it, or your cup of water with ice floating in it? Lake Superior. The answer I'm looking for is the same, right? So more of something isn't more temperature. It's not an extensive variable the way volume and pressure are. It's something like density that is characteristic of the material, right? So if you have a big glass of water or an ocean full of water, it all has the same density, but it has different masses and volumes and potentially pressures. So what we need is an intensive as opposed to an extensive measurement. So roughly speaking, what temperature is it's the energy per molecule. So if we increase the temperature, we have the atoms moving faster, so they have correspondingly more kinetic energy. Now, it's not a very precise definition of temperature. It turns out the actual definition of temperature is pretty tricky. And it took a long time in order to work out fundamentally what temperature really is. And I won't try and describe it. Okay, so let's take a look at some iQuiz questions. So the first one's really from the previous chapter that deals with surface volume ratios. So the argument was made in the book that, well, maybe I won't repeat the argument in the book. So if we look at the skin area per kilogram, and all of these things are made basically of water, so they have the same volume, which one of these has the most surface area? So we've got a kilogram of grapes, and we're comparing it to a kilogram of three other fruits and D. Which of these kilograms has the most surface area? So it goes the other way. So it's not C and B, it's A. So if we have, if we look at for spheres, if we look at the ratio of the surface, 4 pi r squared, to the volume, roughly it goes like 1 over the radius. So in terms of the surface volume ratio, the smaller the object, the more surface area you have. So this is an important reason why cells are small, so that they can have a huge, relatively speaking, a huge amount of surface area that they can use to exchange chemicals with the outside compared to the stuff that's inside of it.
Right, so isn't it B and C?
No, so we want the smaller the object, the more surface area it has.
Saying which one has more?
You asked a different question than what's on the screen.
more skinning. Oh yeah, yep, thank you. I asked a different question. I didn't read my own question. Which of these temperatures is the warmest? Yeah, that's two-handed. Which is warmest? Everything I see is correct. And so 10 degrees Fahrenheit is below freezing. 10 degrees Kelvin is below the temperature of liquid nitrogen. 250 Kelvin is, you know, a pretty cold day, minus 20 degrees Celsius. So A, not that different probably from the temperature outside later today. Which of the following temperature change is the largest amount of cooling? Yeah, this is a two-handed one, right? In terms of a change in temperature, a change of 10 degrees Celsius is exactly the same as 10 degrees Kelvin. Kelvin and Celsius just differ by a constant, so differences in Celsius equals differences in Kelvin. And of course, degrees Fahrenheit are smaller by this ratio of 5 to 9. Which has more heat? So heat is an extensive quantity, right? So Lake Superior is cold, but there's a lot of energy in Lake Superior. I'm warmer than Lake Superior, but I'm not very big, at least compared to Lake Superior. So Lake Superior has more heat. Which is hotter? Well, so there are all sorts of meanings of hotter, I guess. Hotter is kind of an ambiguous term. So higher temperature, how's that? Which has a higher temperature?
So when we talk about which has more heat, if you're a larger body of water with low heat, so how does that kind of disperse? Like per molecule?
So where is it?
More mass to it, it means there's more heat to it?
Yes. Okay. So but you have maybe a secondary question, if you compare something that's half as big and twice as hot, how does it compare? Roughly speaking. So we'll be able to make that comparison in greater detail after we talk about specific heat, which is the amount of heat per gram. And if the specific heat were a constant, that would be the case. But specific heats vary a little bit.
But there would be a way to like
yes.
Take a large amount of ice and it would have the same heat as you.
Yeah, a large amount of liquid nitrogen will have more heat than I have. Just because eventually there'll be more, there won't be a whole lot of energy per molecule, but eventually I'll have enough molecules to make up for that difference. Okay, so I mean, hotter is probably a bad word to use because it's ambiguous, right? Higher temperature would have been a much better phrase. Say again?
What was that?
A lot of people were saying B. I don't know if we're quite ready for this one or not.
No, I don't think we're ready.
You don't think we're ready for that one?
No.
Well, I don't know. So I'm sure you've all seen these cold packs, right? So how do they work? You punch them and they get cold. So what's the explanation for that? You all have taken Gen Chem, right? So, or whatever it's called now. So. So this is like a standard sort of lab to do in an introductory chemistry course to deal with these sorts of reactions. We got 5 minutes. I like your D. So I see a diversity of answers. I see majority D, which is what I like. So cold is just an absence of heat, right? You can't produce cold. You can suck up heat, which is what D is about. So the thermal energy that was present ended up in potential energy and chemical bonds so that there was less thermal energy available. I think that you can agree that punching it probably didn't do what it said. And I don't know, forcibly expelling heat, you're not going to be able to sell that one. So what's involved in this last question is kind of a disagreement between perception of temperature and actual temperature. So you may have heard diamonds called ice because they're cold, right? But you know, the diamond ring probably pretty much at room temperature. Rocks may seem that they're cold. So here we have a bath mat and the tile floor. Standing on the tile floor seems a lot more uncomfortable than standing on the mat. But they're at the same temperature, right? They've been sitting in that room forever. Things that have been in contact for long periods of time typically have the same temperature. So the ones that have to do with at lower temperature are wrong, right? Because objects that are in thermal contact have the same temperature. So it would seem colder. So what's the seeming colder about? Well, how your receptors work is they measure the temperature of your skin. So there are insulators and there are conductors. So if I put my skin on cardboard, the cardboard can't transmit very much heat. Whereas metal, right, put your tongue on a piece of well pump, that can suck up the heat very easily, and so the temperature of my skin goes down noticeably and I feel cold. So thermal conductivity, how much heat the material can conduct, plays a big role in perceptions of temperature. But if you take your thermometer and put it on the mat and put it on the tile, you're going to get exactly the same temperature. Okay.